In this episode, my guest Robin Geigel talks about how overwhelmed she is by reactions to her debut novel, and Justine has another book she couldn't put down, and this one is also written by another Lambda Literary Award nominee. Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, where we feature LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Before you begin your book recommendation, I have just a couple things.
You got it.
The book recommendation page, Graham Cheater put together for us, with a listing of all the books that have been recommended or mentioned on this show for the past year and a half. We have been terrible about updating, or I certainly have been, and it is finally updated. So,
wow. Thank you, Brad.
Yes. Yeah, so I don't want to hear anybody that I know listen to the show, see them online. If somebody says, I'm looking for a book to read, if they don't respond, here's a link where you can find plenty of options to look for. So it's there. You just go to our website, queerwritersofcrime.com, and click on the books mentioned link. And it's a great spreadsheet that lists every book we've ever mentioned.
Yeah. Occasionally I have to go back and look through it to remind myself of what I've read.
I have to look back and sometimes see who I've interviewed, because I'll have a name pop up. I'm like, that name sounds familiar. And I look and I'm like, mm-hmm. No, I didn't interview them. I don't know why they sound familiar, but they do. Also, Lori Lewis Ham with Kings River's Life.
Yes.
Okay, she's been a good friend of ours. She works for Kings River's Life News and Reviews, and she's done quite a few reviews for people that have been guests on the show, such as myself, Dharma Kelleher, I know Joe Constantino, and I think Matt Lubbers Moore is writing some reviews for her.
No, he's writing the Coming Attractions column.
Okay, he's writing the Cummings Attractions column. Well, Kings River's Life is a California magazine, general magazine, but they have a news and reviews section, and Lori Lewis Ham does the mystery section, and it's not strictly LGBTQ, but she has made a very concerted effort to make sure she reaches out to the LGBT community, especially every June. Well, they have a podcast, and I don't think I brought it up before.
Okay.
It's short. It runs about, I would say, 20 minutes. I think probably the longest I've heard is 30 minutes, and it's every other week. And
wow, you think I can go work there, Brad?
I'm already giving you that long.
No, every other week. That sounds like an easy schedule to me.
Oh, that is an easier schedule than what we deal with. I will grant you that. And I actually was told when I started this podcast, we should start out only doing every other week and see if we can work out to every week. But I just jumped right in.
Yep. Just don't go to twice a week, okay?
No, we're not going to go to twice a week. I couldn't handle that. But it's every other week, and they read short stories and chapters from mystery novels. They're read by local actors here in California, but of course, anybody around the world should be interested in a good mystery. And they can listen to the episodes, or they can subscribe to them. If they go to Mystery Rats Maze podcast, which I'm going to leave the link in the show notes.
Yeah, there you go.
They can listen to it there, or Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and all the usual good places. It's a nice little listen. I'd recommend it. I was talking to Lori, and I said, you know, I haven't brought that up on the show yet, so I'm going to mention it. So just wanted to toss that out there.
Okay.
What do you have for us today?
Well, I've got another book off that Lambda Literary Awards nominee list for the finalists in the mystery category, the LGBTQ mystery category.
Okay, who we got this week?
I've got I Hope You're Listening by Tom Ryan. Tom Ryan lives and writes with his husband and his dog. And this book is a young adult novel with a lesbian main character. Tom took the first three chapters of the book and submitted it to the Lambda Literary Writers Retreat for Emerging LGBTQ Voices, and he got in.
Well, that's impressive. That's not easy to get into.
No, and it really shows the, given the quality, and he, in his acknowledgments, he talks about how much input he got and help from the rest of the group on crafting this novel. And it's a cut above many of what's out there. So it's a young adult novel. These are 17-year-olds.
Have we done a young adult novel before?
We have. Marco Riomonte's Murder at White Oak and Butcher of Oxford in his Jake Weston series. Those are young adult novels.
Mark Zubrow's writing young adult, and I talked to him about it when he was a guest. And we have quite a few of our listeners I know read young adult novels, because a lot of them are really good.
Yes. Oh, yeah. They're really great.
And here you have another one.
here I have another one. And if we didn't have so many explicit warnings on our podcasts, I would encourage young people to listen and do more books for them. But you know how that is. We can't just keep our guests under control, can we, Brad?
No, I will keep my mouth clean this week.
Okay. All right.
And anyway, have you read into young adult novels, they certainly do not dance around profanity.
I don't know, because apparently I don't see profanity.
Okay.
I'll hand books to my daughter who doesn't really care for profanity. And she said, man, they use the F word a lot in this book. And I'm like, really? I didn't even notice. She rolls her eyes at me.
Yeah, I was in some writers groups where we would share our readings. And the ones that wrote young adult, I would like, that stuff's in young adult novels these days? They're like, yeah. And I'm like, well, I must be old. Not back in my day.
Back in your day, the young adult novels were very sanitized and there wasn't much adult stuff in them.
Yep.
Well, that's, for all I know, you know, what was in the library was sanitized. You could buy stuff that was more gripping. But nevertheless, Delia is the main character. And she and Burke grew up together with another girl in the neighborhood, Sibby. And one day when Burke is off at the movies with a bunch of other kids and a couple of the neighborhood grown-ups, Delia and Sibby, well, they're seven, they go off to play in this treehouse, and Sibby gets abducted. And Delia gets tied up and left there and has, in the 10 years since, dealt with survivor's guilt. And as the logical thing, even her logical thing, is what could a seven-year-old who was tied up and gagged have done? But she still feels like she didn't do anything and she lost her friend. So she channels this into a podcast, a true crime podcast, where she hands out the facts of an ongoing missing persons case. And her listeners, who are called the Laptop Detective Agency, go out and in real time investigate these missing persons cases, and they have indeed solved many of these cases. And so she feels like she's giving back.
Interesting premise.
It's an interesting premise. And then there's a young girl who moves in across the street into this old abandoned house. And they, it's interesting because I don't know about you growing up, but being gay when I was growing up was kind of like something to notice, but it was very matter of fact in here. They fall in love, they flirt some, they go to the school dance together, and nobody reacts at all. And that is just a part of the story and doesn't really fit anywhere into the plot. So I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it wasn't that matter of fact in my neighborhood, but that's wonderful. I love it when books don't feel like they have to go there every time.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I thought that was really great. So the girl across the street is Sarah, and she ends up, no one knows about this podcast, or that she disguises her voice on it. She doesn't tell anybody who she is. The only one who knows is her friend Burke, who has done the cybersecurity so nobody can hack into the system or trace it back to her. But Sarah somehow figures out that it's her podcast, and she finally has someone to talk to about this. Meanwhile, she's moved away from that house in the neighborhood, and the family that has moved into her house has their child abducted. And this is either it's a copycat or it's the same person 10 years apart. There's pressure from Burke, somewhat from Sarah, but certainly from Burke, to use her podcast to find this missing child. And she does not want to do this. She has created this to give herself some distance. She doesn't investigate. She doesn't want to have any input or any relationship between her and the missing cases that she puts on the show. And this causes a rift between her and Burke. And it's some of the tension in the first part of the novel is from that, and also from the fact that there's another child missing, and it's brought up all these old memories. She eventually gets pulled into it and ends up investigating, talking to a lot of people, and she solves it eventually. And that is the second part of the book. It's very exciting. It builds very logically from a kind of peaceful kid recording from a podcast from her bedroom to an exciting climax, a pretty satisfying ending. If you can have a satisfying ending with missing children, and it's terrific.
It's sounds really, really good. I love the premise.
Yeah, I think it's a great premise, and it's very well written and well played out. Not very predictable. You know, if you think of your favorite true crime podcast and try to figure out how they would go about investigating a case, I'm not sure they would have the same creativity or effort this young lady puts in.
And I'll say this, neither the Hardy Boys nor did Nancy Drew have a podcast.
That's right. That's right. And there's a fair amount of Nancy Drew style mystery solving and a few Nancy Drew style clues along the way. Although I think things get a little more tense than they did in a lot of the Nancy Drew novels.
Well, I know a lot of the authors that I've interviewed on here said that they grew up really enjoying the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. So I'm sure many of our listeners have as well. So they will get into that part of it.
Unfortunately, I think this is a standalone. I don't think Delia's going to have a lot of other books. He has written two other young adult books. The first one, which was before this one, was Keep This to Yourself. It's about a serial killer who terrorizes a small town, and it's also a young adult book. The next one, which is due out on May 4th, is called When You Get the Chance. And the tagline is Cousins on a Road Trip to Pride. And that sounds like a very interesting book. It doesn't look like a mystery.
Sounds good.
I'm giving this one an intriguing recommendation.
We've had a lot of intriguing lately.
Yeah, I'm kind of an intriguing kind of mood.
And you have really been on a roll with like books you've been really excited about.
I have. It's been a good run. Now, yeah. I got to say, all of our books I'm excited about.
Yes.
But sometimes you got to kind of dig through the pile to get to them. And these have just all kind of popped up to the top. And I'm really pleased. I'm enjoying my reading lately.
Yeah, I want to remind everybody, Justine does not do book reviews. She does book recommendations only. So sometimes I get these messages that are like, I had to put another one down. I got to find another one. I had to put another one down. I got to find another one. And lately, she has not done that.
Lately, I say, boy, this is great. Oh, you're really going to love this one. I'm really excited about this one. And that this is one of them. Yeah, I think I texted you, this is a good choice. This was a very good choice.
Yeah, you've sent me messages sometimes sweating, like, how am I going to get anything done in time for our recording? Because I don't know what I'm going to talk about.
Some of these books I put down, just so people know, some of these books I put down are great books, but I'm just not in the mood for that kind of mystery. And as you say, we've had some intriguing ones lately, and I have been in a mood for intriguing. And so I've picked books that kind of fit into that category.
And that's an important point. A lot of times it's not the book is not all that great. It's just not you're in the space for that particular type of story.
Right. And you know, a lot of these books, the last several books, there has not been a lot of relationship angst. And I have not been in the mood for relationship angst. And the last few books have not had that. We had the Chris Holcomb book, and then we had Nighthawking, and now we have this one, and none of them have any relationship angst in them.
That's refreshing.
Yeah. Of course, you know, next week I may be back to relationship angst again. You never know with me.
It's something we all can relate to.
That's right. Okay, Brad, that's all I have for this week. Everybody should run out and get Dead as a Doornail by Grant Michaels. I talked about it on last week's show. Keep buying it.
See you next week. If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you hear our show. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Brad. How are you?
I'm doing great. Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime. It's a pleasure to have you on.
It's an honor to be on.
I'm going to read your introduction, but before I do so, I want to tell you there's something about it that made me laugh. And I'll tell you about it when I'm done with the intro.
Okay. Fair enough.
So here we go. Robin Geigel, the author of By Way of Sorrow, is an attorney, author, and activist who has been honored by the ACLU New Jersey and the New Jersey Pride Network for her work on behalf of the LGBTQ+ community. She has been appointed by the New Jersey Supreme Court to the Court's Committee on Diversity, Inclusion, and Community Engagement, and by the Governor and Legislature of the Jersey Transgender Equality Task Force. She is a member of the Board of Directors of Garden State Equality, New Jersey's largest LGBTQ+ civil rights organization. Robin lives in New Jersey, where she continues to practice law by day and work on her next Aaron McCabe novel by night. Fortunately, she has a very boring social life. Now I got to get to why I think it's funny. Because in addition to all that, there's more. You speak frequently on issues and provide training to corporations, the New Jersey State Police, the U.S. Attorney General's Office in New Jersey, the New Jersey Office of the Attorney General, the New Jersey Office of the Public Defender, and many others. You don't have a boring social life. You have no time for a social life.
This is all true. You're 100% correct.
I don't know how you do it, but we may get to that later, and we're certainly going to get to some of the things we just talked about. But first, let's start with the novel, By Way of Sorrows. This is the first Aaron McCabe legal thriller, and I'm going to start off with another list here. I can't read all the accolades that you've received, but I'm going to go through a few. The New York Times Book Review said that Geigel is too astute and compassionate a writer to create cartoon villainy out of anti-trans attitudes. Quietly groundbreaking. Booklist said Geigel is a transgender lawyer herself, providing provocative insights into the legal system and the challenges of gender identity. Publishers Weekly said Geigel, an attorney, offers some enlightening insights into the workings of the legal world. You also had great reviews from Mystery Scene. Author Edwin Hill, who is a guest on the show, excellent writer, had some really good things to say, as well as some additional best-selling authors. I got to say, I was really impressed when I started reading this novel because I generally skip the forwards. It drives people crazy when I tell them that. I'm glad I didn't skip your forward because it grabbed me immediately. And I really would have missed out. What I found really surprising is I knew this was the first in the Aaron McCabe thriller series. What I didn't know at the beginning was that this was your debut novel. How, as a first-time novelist, does all that attention feel?
Overwhelming. And I am a debut novelist, but there's a but here. I started writing my first novel 40 years ago. I was about 28 at the time. And back then, there were no computers, it was all longhand on yellow legal pads. And I probably got about 200 pages in writer's block and family and career and everything else took over, and it sat in a briefcase for decades. And then after I transitioned and I was living on my own and I had some time, I wrote a novel, finished a manuscript prior to By Way of Sorrow. And that, fortunately, never saw the light of day. Otherwise, I wouldn't be getting these accolades. It was a learning process. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to think that those experiences helped get me to be a better writer so that when I sat down to do By Way of Sorrow, I had some experiences that were not as successful as By Way of Sorrow so far has turned out to be. So nonetheless, the things that you've said, the reviews that you've read, it has been incredibly overwhelming, absolutely surreal. I walked into my local Barnes & Noble yesterday and saw it on the new release, prominently displayed. And it took my breath away.
Novels by transgender authors and with a transgender protagonist are really difficult to get published by a traditional publishing house. Now, I know this is your first novel, but based on your experience, do you think that's changing based on things you may have heard? Or if you're not sure, do you have any advice for transgender authors that are struggling with this?
Well, certainly, Tori Peters' novel, Detransition Baby, which came out, I guess, in January, has gotten some notoriety and a lot of press. I don't know the answer to the question. I'd like to think that the landscape is changing. If you look at not so much the book world, but if you look at what's on television, and by television, I mean Netflix and Hulu and everything else, you're starting to see more transgender characters, and you're seeing more people in the industry that are involved in producing those stories. From Laverne Cox, Janet Mock, all those people, they're changing the landscape. And so I'd like to think that that's spilling over somewhat into the publishing world. And, I have to thank Kensington Books and my editor, John Scamiglio, for taking a chance on me, because I am a debut author. And it was a book with two transgender characters. And I am a transgender woman. So it was a big risk. And yet they took it. And I'd like to think they took it because it's a good book. And I hope that the moral of the story is, if there's a good book with good characters, even if those characters are trans, written by a trans author, that those books will see the light of day. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I'm hoping that we're seeing a change in the landscape. I know, I know Dharma Kelleher is out there and has been out there for a long time, and self-publishes, had a deal back in the day and then decided, she wanted to self-publish. So there's been other people who have broken the ground before me. And I hope that it's changing. I hope that there's going to be a broader acceptance. And I hope that there's room for these stories mainstream, because I wanted to write a mainstream book. I wanted to write a book that, whether you're part of the LGBTQ+ community, or you're the straightest couple sitting on the beach, you want to read this book because it's a good book, it's a legal thriller, and it grabs you and it holds on to you. And in the process, maybe you learn a little bit about the transgender community.
Dharma's been on the show a couple of times.
I know she has.
And we're in contact quite often. And she shared on this show, as well as some other authors I've interviewed, that their frustration that they got back from publishing houses was, we already did a transgender novel this year, which is really depressing.
Very depressing.
I hope that's changing.
I do too, because I'd like to think, again, to the extent, and I've only just recently started Dharma's Jinx Blue series, and I love her work. I think it's great. I'd like to think that we're so different in terms of what we're writing about, even though we have trans characters. Mm-hmm. It's like, reading something by two different authors in two different genres. Not that hers isn't thrilling and an adventure. It is. I love it. But Jinx Blue is not Erin McCabe. And so I would hope that there's enough room in the literary world for any number of transgender characters, because no transgender character is the same as any other. We're all different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her novels are quite a bit different than yours, but they're both great novels. So, yeah, there is no cookie-cutter way to make a good book.
Right. Same with cisgender people, same with gay men, lesbians, bi people. There's so many different characters. There's so many different people who inhabit that space. There's lots of different stories to tell.
Now, when you were in law school, did you ever imagine that you would be doing so much work on behalf of the LGBTQ community, and especially the trans community, as well as writing a novel with a trans character?
The answer is definitely not. I was so far in the closet back then that my closet had closets. I never envisioned that I'd be out and open as a trans woman. Something that I've always known about myself since I was 3, 4, 5 years old. But I was born in a different time, born in 1952. Things were a lot different. I had no way of knowing there were other people like me. I was probably into my 20s before I knew that there were other people who were transgender. And the word that was used back, the terminology wasn't even transgender back then. You had transvestites and you had transsexual people. And so it was so different. And so I never imagined that I'd be out and open about my gender identity and who I am. But, life's journey takes us places that we don't necessarily expect to go. And obviously, I am happy to be myself, to live my authentic life. And as I said, writing was something I always wanted to do. And with grown children, living on my own, I did have the time, because I don't have a social life, to sit down at night and write. And because I was then out and open, it was okay for me to write about the trans experience, because I had, at least for myself, lived one portion of that, I have that journey. It's just my journey. It's different than every other trans person's experience, but I felt like I could speak to that. And so 43 years ago, when I was graduating law school, not even a thought in my mind that I'd be here, this where I am now.
Well, it was kind of a silly question, because I pretty much thought that would be the answer, but I love you saying that you are happy that you're living your authentic life. That's wonderful to hear.
No, it's been such a blessing, and I consider myself incredibly blessed. I have a wife who's still my best friend. We don't live together anymore, but we're still incredibly close. I have three amazing children who, as I said, are all adults who love me just as much as they loved me before. I have four amazing granddaughters. So my life is truly blessed, and I couldn't be happier.
Well, let's get to the book, starting with the main character, your protagonist, attorney Aaron McCabe. Tell us about Aaron.
Aaron is a 35-year-old trans woman who also happens to be a lawyer, and she does criminal defense. In other words, she represents people who are accused of crimes. And when the book starts, it's set in 2006, 2007. And as I said, Aaron's 35. It comes out during the course of the book that approximately 2 years before the events of the case that they get involved in, Aaron had transitioned. So she transitioned about 2 years prior to that, and she's in a law partnership with a fellow by the name of Dwayne Swisher, who's an African-American male and former FBI agent. And they're running this law firm representing criminal defendants.
Let's talk about the story. Share what you can.
So the story involves the death. I don't want to use the word murder, because it's an open-ended question as to whether it was murder or self-defense. But mm-hmm. the stabbing death of the only son of one of the most powerful politicians and richest men in the southern part of the state of New Jersey. And the person who is charged with his murder is a young trans woman of color who is also a sex worker by the name of Charisse Barnes. And early on in the story, Dwayne and Aaron are referred the case by another criminal defense attorney who is one of the most prominent criminal defense attorneys in the state, but doesn't feel he can take the case because he knows the deceased father. And because he's so powerful, nobody wants to run afoul of William Townsend, who is the gentleman involved, the politician involved. And so Aaron and Dwayne are referred this case. They take it on, and the story involves what happened in the motel room the night that William Townsend Jr. was stabbed. Was it self-defense? Was it murder? And that's what the story is about. And mixed in with that, of course, as a result of Aaron and Dwayne representing a transgender sex worker, the story comes out that Aaron is transgender, and that plays into the mix. So you get the backstory on Aaron, you get the backstory on Charisse, and how someone's gender identity, in Charisse's case, her race, and then on the flip side, how power and money on the other side, how that stew all comes together in what we call the justice system.
One thing I'm curious about, starting with the prologue, I said it was gripping, and I hope you don't mind me saying what it is, because it's right at the beginning. It is the murder.
Right.
And it wasn't grotesque in any way, but it grabs you. It seemed very real. Immediately following that, you kept this amazing pace because I believe it's right at the beginning of chapter one where Aaron goes to a judge to have him recused off a case. And the reason is because of his homophobic background. And it's a battle, and he does recuse himself. And I have to ask the question, is that based on an actual occurrence?
No. Okay. I will tell you what I tell everybody. You know, I've been practicing law for 43 years, and probably for about 37 of those years in, to a greater or lesser extent, in amongst other things that I did criminal defense work. So I have a familiarity with what goes on in criminal cases. So it wasn't like I had no background in that. And there's certainly things that I've seen and experienced that you take those little nuggets as an author and build something off of them. But nothing that happens in By Way of Sorrow is based on anything that I personally experienced, with the exceptions of some of the lived experiences that Erin has as a trans woman. But in terms of the legal procedures, the case, the characters that are involved, the rich politician, the prosecutor, all of those people, they're composite, made-up people from 43 years of experience. The only character that is close to someone in my life is Erin's mom, Peg McCabe, who is based loosely on my own mom. And Peg is really an homage to my mom and how she dealt with her child coming out when I did as a transgender woman.
Well, it's a wonderful tribute.
Yeah, my mom was an amazing woman. She passed away back in December before the book came out. She's just an amazing woman. She was 96, had a wonderful, wonderful sense of humor. And there's a few lines that Peg dishes out during the course of the book that are paraphrased from real conversations between my mom and I.
Well, the reason I asked about the recusal is it seemed real to me. And even though you said it's not based on an actual event, based on your experience as an attorney over the years, could you see that as a real thing that could occur?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, there's no question about it. I certainly, maybe I haven't had the experience of dealing with the homophobic judge, but I certainly know enough people in the LGBTQ plus legal community who have dealt with judges who are either homophobic or transphobic or just maybe not sensitive to the issues that they're dealing with when they're dealing with issues involving people in the community. So yes, I could absolutely see it happening. And again, remember, this is set in 2006, 2007. So we were in a very different environment in terms of people's knowledge, certainly about transgender issues back then. It was not as widely talked about, well known. You know, Caitlyn hadn't come out yet. You know, so there was less exposure, less discussion about the issue.
Well, I won't ask what you think of Caitlyn. We'll skip right over that one.
Fair enough.
Two of your characters, Charisse, the sex worker who is accused of the crime, and I can't remember the Aaron's partner.
Dwayne Switcher.
Dwayne.
Yeah.
They're both African American.
Right.
How comfortable did you feel writing about Black individuals?
So, to explain a little bit of the background of Charisse, I had finished the first novel, that the manuscript that I said had never gotten published, but I had gotten an agent that was being shopped around. So I had some time, and I was reading a lot at that point, and I reread To Kill a Mockingbird. And I'm not comparing my book to Kill a Mockingbird, but I was struck by the fact of how much of To Kill a Mockingbird is about the trial of Tom Robinson. And I was frustrated because we never get in Tom Robinson's head. We never understand what he's thinking, how a black man in the 30s accused of molesting a white woman in the Deep South, he must have known that he had no chance. But of course, that story's all told from the point of view of Scout, the young narrator of the story. And I was just frustrated and thinking, well, it would be fascinating to be in his head. And so the first character that I actually came up with was Charisse, because I said, you know, it'd be interesting to do it from the point of view of a trans woman of color who's accused of a crime and get in her head. And then I said, no, I can't do that. That's not my story to tell. I can't tell it from that point of view because that's not my lived experience. And so that's how come Erin is born, so to speak, because she becomes the central voice in the story. But I still loved Charisse, and I still wanted that as part of the story. So what I did was, after I did the first draft, I contacted a friend of mine who works at a not-for-profit, who's also an African-American male, and said, look, can you do me a favor? Can you take a look at this? And he works with a number of trans women of color, both as volunteers and who are part of the office. And I asked him if he would have them take a look at it to make sure that I was authentic to that experience and that I was telling it fairly and appropriately. And he did me that favor and shared it. And of course, you share it with other people. So in terms of Dwayne, you know, there's attorneys I know, you know, attorneys of color that I'm happy to share this story with and make sure that I'm getting it right, just like I shared it with people I know in law enforcement and on the, you know, prosecutor side. You want to make sure that you're accurately portraying all of the different elements in the story. So I wanted a book that had a lot of diversity. It's very important. Diversity and inclusion is very important to me. As you mentioned, I'm on a Supreme Court committee. And I wanted to represent the legal world in all its diversity. So that's why Dwayne is an African-American male. Charisse, again, you know, it was that here's a woman who has been thrown out by her family, has had a much different life than Erin has had. And I wanted to be able to get in her head, but I wanted to be able to get into her head authentically. And so it's not really from her point of view. It's more from Erin's point of view.
Were you concerned about subconsciously falling into any stereotypes?
Absolutely. Not even subconsciously. I was very concerned about doing it consciously. You know, in the sense that I was very conscious of not falling into them subconsciously. You know, you don't want to do tropes. You don't want to have the white savior, you know, who's helping the poor, defenseless, you know, black woman who's charged with this crime. Charisse had to be a strong, independent character who stood on her own, but was in a situation where she needed a lawyer. So I was very conscious of those things. I hope it certainly was my goal to make Charisse a strong, independent woman who Erin is not the white savior. Erin is her lawyer. They're equals. They're working together to get a good result for Charisse at the end of the day.
Charisse and Dwayne, tell us a little bit about them.
So Charisse is 19 years old. As I said, she's had a very different life experience than Erin, in the sense that when she came out, I shouldn't even say she came out. She was discovered by her parents. And you learn through the story that ultimately she leaves home when she's 15 years old and lives on the street. And like many people who are forced, you know, there's so many LGBTQ folks who are homeless at such a young age because either they're thrown out of their homes or because it's safer out on the streets for them to be at home with families that don't accept them and persecute them and treat them badly. So Charisse winds up on the street. And as many young people do who wind up on the street, you how do you survive? You survive through survival crimes, and be that drugs or sex work. That's the only opportunities that are available to you. And so Charisse is a sex worker and has a long rap sheet because, you know, she works in Atlantic City, gets arrested frequently because she's out on the streets. And that's where she is when she meets young Mr. Townsend. In Dwayne's case, Dwayne is Ivy educated. He was a basketball player, went to Brown University. His nickname is Swish because his last name is Swisher, but also because he's a basketball player, it's a perfect nickname for him because his shot from three-point range was so sweet. He had met Erin prior to her transition because Lauren, Erin's wife, who they're now divorced, they divorced when Erin transitioned, had been roommates with Dwayne's then girlfriend, future wife, Corinne. And so that's how they meet. They're dating girlfriends and they form a friendship. And they all both go off to law school. Dwayne, when he comes out, goes into the FBI. Erin goes to the public defender's office after a year clerkship. And they come back together after Erin leaves the public defender's office and sets up her own practice. And Dwayne resigns in good standing from the FBI. And there's a backstory there that we won't go into too much because I don't want to give away any spoilers.
Oh, no. Don't do that.
And so they have this common bond. Erin, they form their partnership before Erin transitions. And then Erin comes out and they remain in partnerships, in a partnership, and continue on in their line of work. And so that's who Dwayne is. He's Erin's partner, probably her closest friend. And there they are.
Their friendship is very real.
Thank you.
Charisse, you mentioned earlier that you hope some people learn something along the way. Charisse is in jail as a man.
Correct.
And throughout the book, sometimes Charisse is referred to as he, sometimes she. And it wasn't confusing to me, but probably for the first time, I really got this. I can only imagine how that would feel. And you opened my eyes a little bit. When you were writing this novel, were you writing things just authentically and it's the way that these things came out? Or were you actually, as you wrote it, said, I hope it opened some eyes and teach people something along the way?
The latter. I was, as I said earlier, I wanted to write a thriller that would appeal to as broad an audience as possible. But I also knew that I could come at the legal thriller genre from a very unique perspective as a trans woman writing about trans characters. So I didn't want the message to overwhelm the story, but I wanted it to fit naturally into the story so that when, for example, Charisse is misgendered by the judge and the judge refuses to address her as her and uses male pronouns and refuses to use Charisse, those are all, although they certainly misgendering happens to most trans people, including myself, pronouns not being used correctly, sometimes inadvertently, sometimes on purpose. Those are all experiences that I think a lot of trans people have had, and certainly I had. But in terms of that and how it resonates with people, that was something that I wanted to build into the story and make it just inherently part of the story so that it fit organically. And it wasn't so that somebody reading it go, oh, there she goes again, off on a rant about, you know, transgender issues. In fact, there's one point in one of the conversations that take place in the judge's chambers where the prosecutor accuses Erin of doing just that. She's like, no, this is who my client is. And that's what I wanted it to be. This is just who they are. And it's part of the story.
I'm curious, the jail time that Charisse had, was she wasn't treated well.
No.
Los Angeles has a floor. The jail is huge. There is a floor that is the LGBTQ floor. And straight individuals that are arrested have actually pretended to be gay so they could get on that floor because it's known as being a good floor to be on. And anybody that goes through the process, they are questioned heavily to ensure that they're truly gay. And I'm curious, because I was really surprised that, and I thought it was a wonderful thing. Is that something that exists in other major cities, do you know?
In 2006, 2007, when I set this, at least for New Jersey, the answer was no. And I will say, when we're talking about county jails, because Charisse is charged, so she's not in a state prison. She's in a county jail awaiting trial. And county jails tended to have policies that are different from, at least in New Jersey, from county to county. I don't know how it is in California, maybe Los Angeles, because it is, you know, a big city with, you know, a very diverse population. Maybe that's normal for them, where you might not find that somewhere else in California. At least in New Jersey, 2006, 2007, really transgender individuals, and again, with it, there's really no spoiler here, Charisse has not had what we would call gender-confirming surgery. So she still has male genitalia. And I will tell you that even up until very recently in New Jersey, despite the fact that there's policies and procedures in place that are supposed to protect transgender inmates, so often trans women who hadn't had gender-confirming surgery were housed in men's facilities. And it still takes place, unfortunately. And it's so horrible. Hopefully that's changing. But as you can imagine, there's such a political backlash in terms of trying to convince, and it rears its head several times in the book, that you don't have to have gender-confirming surgery to be a woman. A transgender person, their gender identity is who they are. And unfortunately, in so many spaces, and we see it across the country now in terms of trans athletes and trans healthcare for kids, there's such a pushback against trans people. And so that's real. The part about her being put in basically solitary confinement, supposedly for her protection, is real. That really happened in New Jersey jails and in New Jersey prisons. So, you know, again, I've never had that experience, but I know it existed. And I'm involved in a case now involving a transgender inmate. So, I mean, those are things that exist. And I wanted to, hopefully, again, educate people as to what it's like for trans people.
Well, as far as educating people about Charisse, I was interviewed recently, and it's the reason it's on the top of my head right now. I only had one close friend that died of AIDS because I came out very late, as you did. And I had always suspected something, but in the hospital, we were talking, and he said, regarding having AIDS, he said, you know, I guess this is what happens when you're a hustler. And in talking to him, I found out he was kicked out of his home, and his only way to survive was street work. So I really appreciate that you hopefully opened some eyes in that as well, because that happens way too often. Here in Hollywood, the homeless rate of LGBTQ kids is unbelievable because they all come to California, especially Hollywood, thinking it's going to be glamorous and exciting.
I don't know what the statistics are in LA, California, but I can tell you in New York City, the statistic is 40% of all homeless kids in New York City are LGBTQ. 40%. It's horrible.
Yeah. It's unreal and yet not surprising.
No, it's not, unfortunately. Because so many of those kids, it's not like they're born and raised in New York and they're now homeless. They were born and raised in Oklahoma or Mississippi or someplace else. And, you know, like the people that come to Hollywood thinking that it's safe and it's going to be glamorous, people make their way to where they think it's going to be safe. New York City, you know, progressive Northeast. And when they get here, there's nothing for them.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into politics a little bit. And not just politics, but the general society. You transitioned in 2009.
Correct.
And I read a quote somewhere that you said, let me get that correctly. You said, people who referred work to me for 10 to 15 years suddenly stopped. The only thing that had changed was my name from Robert to Robin. Care to share that experience?
So it was 2009, so kind of similar time frame in terms of where the novel is set, where people were not as familiar with transgender people. And I think what the reaction was by some attorneys was, well, I can't refer work to her because what will my client think when they find out that she's transgender? How will that reflect on me? And they didn't want to have that conversation. And I don't think they should have their need to have that conversation in terms of, I'm still the same lawyer I was after as I was before. Again, the only thing that's changed is how I look and what my name is. I'd like to think that I was even a better lawyer after I transitioned because I was free to be me. That burden that I had carried around my whole life, I had put down. And yet, you know, maybe it was just the time and the place in terms of people not feeling comfortable. I don't know. I don't want to get into other people's decision-making processes, mm-hmm. but it happened. There wasn't a whole lot that I could do about it. And life went on.
Well, what a difficult time period, just like obviously it is now, but Obama was president during the time, and he did sign the executive order to protect people based on their sexual orientation and gender identity. So things were looking up.
Yes. And here in New Jersey, in 2007, the state law against discrimination was amended to include gender identity. So, you know, I was theoretically protected, but the law doesn't necessarily change people's perspective or how they react to you. It's the law. And as I tell people, there's the law and then there's the reality.
That is true. I don't want to stereotype the South, but I grew up in the South. And despite what the laws are, I can tell you racism is... The Klan was practically a social club in my high school. And that surprises people when I tell them that. But things were looking up. And then we know what happened in November of 2016. Things took a turn.
Yes, they did.
How devastating was that to the community? Was there a loss of hope or was it a call to action or both?
I think it was both, honestly. I think there were people who were so devastated. And when you look at it, it's not just the LGBTQ plus community. I mean, look at what happened in terms of racial issues and ethnic issues and religious issues. You know, if you were a Muslim American, if you were a person of color, if you were a member of an immigrant community, I mean, so many things changed in that four-year period. So I think there was a lot of despair and a feeling of how could we be here after where we were and where we were going. And yet, I think, I saw it, there was a resiliency and there was, we're not going to lie down and take this. We're going to push back. And I think you see that in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement. I think you see it in the LGBTQ plus community. I think you see it in the immigrant community. I think you see it in all those communities that for 4 years had targets on their back. And you know, you look at some of them, they've, you know, the Black Lives people, they've had the target on their back for 400 years. I mean, this isn't new to them. But I think people are saying, no, we're not going back to where we were. We're going to push forward. And look, it is discouraging. You take one step forward and you take two steps back. You feel that that frustration, that how can we be here? And yet, if you don't continue forward, you know, you just have to give up hope. And I don't think I'm prepared to give up hope. And I think most people, certainly in the LGBTQ plus community, are not giving up hope. We're here. We're not going away. This is who we are. And you can think what you want about us, but we're real. And this is who we are. And we deserve to be here just as much as anybody.
Well, and things are looking up in a sense. I know you're on the New Jersey Task Force for Equality. Transgender, is it transgender equality task force?
The task force was for transgender equality, and that wrapped up. We issued our final report. You know, one of the things that was part of our final report was to make it, you know, a more permanent thing. Unfortunately, our report came out in November of 19, and then of course this little thing called a pandemic hit a few months later. So I think it's kind of been on the back burner. But yes, I was on the task force.
The reason I brought up is things were looking a little better. The governor of New Jersey wanted to implement some of your recommendations that you gave, which I saw as a positive. We now have Biden in office, which is a positive. And I don't know if you're aware of a recent HRC poll came out that said 70% of voters across all ages, religions, and political parties support the Equality Act. So it's looking good, but again, we have that precarious thing of, you know, these are given and taken away depending on who's in office and who's on the judicial seat. What is your outlook in the long haul? I mean, I'm asking you to look in a crystal ball. I know that's difficult, but...
So I'd like to think, when I look at things from a generational perspective, I'm 68 years old. As I said, I was born in a different time and place. And so my mom was 96 when she passed. She was a different generation, and they had no real concepts in terms of sexual orientation, gender identity. You know, my generation, maybe we progressed a little bit. When I look at my kids' generations, they're all in their 30s. I mean, they all knew somebody who was transgender even before I came out. They all know somebody who's gay or lesbian or bi. Or you know, non-binary. So I am hopeful that as each successive generation matures and comes up and grabs the reins of power from the generation ahead of them, that they will have a better understanding and a better, as you said, just feeling that what's the big deal? I mean, why do I care if you're gay? Why do I care if you're trans? What I care about, are you a good person? Are you honest? Do you help your neighbor? That's what I care about. So the bottom line is, I don't know if I'll live long enough to see it, but I am hopeful that as each successive generation comes along and has been educated to be more open and honest around these issues, that at some point we will get to the point where being gay or being lesbian or being trans is a nothing. It doesn't matter.
Well, as long as we've been working on the race issue and have so far to go, I don't think either of us are going to live long enough to see things the way we want them to be, but I'm hopeful that we'll see things going in the direction that they should be.
I agree with you. The race issue is the one that always tempers my own optimism in terms of all minorities. I mean, if after 400 years we can't have racial equality, you know, what is wrong with us?
Yeah, my daughter is 24, and she and the kids she went to high school with, it was no big a deal. It's like a non-issue that her dad is gay. And she did an internship, and I believe it was in Lithuania, working for... They had a different name for it, but basically an LGBTQ center, trying to get one started off the ground, which somebody tried to burn down. But they're going in the right direction.
As the cliche goes, your lips to God's ears.
Yes, exactly. Well, we're about to wrap up, and you said you've listened to the show. So now it's time for awkward questions authors get. And these, I surveyed dozens of authors, and these are just difficult or strange questions that they've been asked over the years. So I'm going to spin the wheel and we're going to see what you get.
Fair enough. Let's go.
Why is your character gay?
Why is my character gay? My character isn't gay.
Let's say, why is your character transgender?
Because I am a transgender woman and I wanted to write about a transgender character because that is my lived experience and because there are so few authors writing about and writing in their own voice about trans characters. I mean, for so often, trans characters are the victims of the murder or the crazy psycho killer or something else. And I wanted to just write trans characters who were as normal and live their lives just like everybody else. And I wanted them to be authentic and real. And I felt that uniquely, I guess I felt uniquely situated to be able to do that.
In fact, I'm a little frustrated because after I'm done here, I'm going to have to do some editing. And I would rather dive in and finally finish your book. But I'll get around to it probably tomorrow. To remind the listeners, I have Robin Geigel, who is the author of By Way of Sorrow, which I'm happy to hear is the first Aaron McCabe legal thriller, which implies there will be a second one. And it's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much, Brad. It's been an absolute joy to sit and talk to you.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.